1983, 1 o'clock, Hearing Room A, Senate Committee on Energy and Environment, chaired by Senator John Kitzhaber. Hearing on House Bill 2612, repealing expiration date for Pesticide Analytical and Response Center. Work session to follow, House Bill 2235, Senate Bill 720, Senate Bill 237A engrossed, Senate Bill 234, and a possible work session on Senate Bill 405.
Apologize for the delay. We had a late session and had a little difficulty rounding up a quorum, so I do believe we have one. What we're going to do today is have a work session on 237 first, starting with a presentation by the department. We're going to then move to House Bill 2235, which is the wood stove bill. We have three other bills for work session, one a recycling bill, two water bills, and also a bill on the plutonium study bill, and a bill on 234 dealing with aggregate. So let's start with Eldon and company come up, and you should have in your materials here a copy of the memorandum from LCDC concerning from the department, excuse me, concerning 237, and a copy of the amended bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Eldon Hout, Deputy Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. With me is Ron Eber, our policy analyst and agricultural specialist. We've had the opportunity to review the revisions to Senate Bill 237, and we believe that this is an important step in improving the bill and making it more workable, and we think the bill is an improvement and a step forward in improving the program. The department and the commission support this bill and would like to briefly suggest to you some amendments that would provide even greater flexibility in its application and to the number of areas to which it will apply. And Ron Eber has done the basic analysis of this, and I'd like to have him take you through the sections that we believe can be improved.
For the record, my name's Ron Eber with the department. What I'll do is just go through and mention the sections and the page numbers. Some are housekeeping and some are more major. On pages 1 and 2 of these proposed amendments, we would simply note that the exclusion from the definition of agricultural land for lands which are built upon or committed should come out of this bill. That has been incorporated into the exceptions process language that was looked at previously, and it's unnecessary here. It's covered over in that section. So that's on lines 26 and 27 of page 1 and lines 1 and 2 of page 2. Then into the definition of marginal lands, which begins on page 2, a couple of items. On line 5, where it says under large A, no exception has been approved for the land, I'm referring to the statute dealing with acknowledgement. As the present practice is, we sometimes approve exception areas through a continuance order, and we never look at them again, but they're not, so they're approved, but they're not technically acknowledged. We would suggest changing the word approved to acknowledged. In that way, a county that has gone that far but still would want to apply the marginal lands concept and utilize some of the lands that had gone through the exceptions process that might more appropriately go through the marginal lands concept, they would be able to do that mix. Washington County is an example where we have signed off, I think, on all the exception areas except for a couple of the built and committed ones, but this would give the county the option to remix that, the exception in the EFU areas.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir Day.
In your opinion, does Section 21A prohibit the designation of agricultural lands and urban growth boundaries inside urbanized areas for farm tax deferral, continued farm designation?
You're back on page 1?
Yes.
this, as I read this, this would exclude from the definition of agricultural land under Goal 3, lands within acknowledged urban growth boundaries.
And would that affect their tax status? And could it under this bill?
No, because the county would still, it would take them out of the obligation or the requirement of Goal 3 to be zoned for exclusive farm use. The county still retains the option to zone it for exclusive farm use or something else, and then they can still qualify through either tax provision, either the EFU or the unzoned system. So it doesn't affect the tax status.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Back on page 2, line 7, where it says the land is not part of a farm operation that produced $20,000 or more in gross income, et cetera. The way that in the whole definition works, it's a three-part test, and you're looking to see whether land in small parcels or land that is considered low in productivity is part of a farm operation that grossed over $20,000. The way this is worded now, if a parcel that meets one of the other two tests in any way contributes to that farm operation of over $20,000, even if it's $1, it would take it out of that ability. It would take it out of the ability to qualify as marginal land. We would suggest rewording it to say the land does not make a significant contribution to a farm operation, and in that way, a county can judge whether this is being grazed or utilized really as part of that operation or as just something off to the side and is insignificant. I think it, particularly in eastern Oregon, this would have a good effect for more land qualifying, because you may have a large ranch with some land that you're really not utilizing. You might run a couple of head of cattle out there, but it's really not part of your general pasture program or whatever. So we would suggest that language, and then it wouldn't be such an absolute standard. In the next part of the definition, again on page 2, lines 11 and lines 15, we would recommend reducing the acreage in both cases from 320 acres to 100 acres. We think the 100 acres is a more manageable planning unit. It would allow, probably in the coastal areas, more lands to qualify, because you wouldn't have to have so much acreage in one spot to qualify. And our review of exception areas over the years, most of them come in units around 100 acres or so, and that's a good low side figure. Going any lower might allow a lot of scattered sites to come into it, and you could undermine the statutory provision in 215-253, which prevents counties from restricting farming practices unless those farming practices bother someone in a non-EFU zone. So if you had a lot of scattered marginal land zones out there, those people could complain about the farm practices in an EFU zone. And so I think 100 acres is the good workable unit. We would recommend keeping the 20-acre figure and the 50% figure there for two reasons. Our experience in looking at the built and committed exceptions is that 20 acres is really the break point between where parcels get so small that it is questionable, except in berry operations or nursery operations, that they're really available any longer for commercial farm use. Those over 20 acres still have that potential, and so when you get down much lower than below 20, it's really not workable. And we think the 50%, having within a 100-acre area, 50% at least in the 20-acre or smaller parcels is a reasonable percentage for judging whether or not it's really been cut up. We would note down on line 19 under the forest land figure, it has there 50 cubic feet of timber per acre per year. That is the, as we understand it, the definition of commercial timberland that is used by the State Department of Forestry. The U.S. Forest Service uses 20 cubic acre feet per acre per year. It's our understanding that for the industry's purposes, when they look at reforestation, they look at 85 cubic feet per acre per year. either one of those figures, 50 or 85, is workable.
Mr. Chairman?
Indeed.
Now, the way this is written now, and lands that were tested with this income test for $20,000 in the last 3 or 5 years preceding the effective date of this act are the only ones going to qualify. And there's no going to be succeeding qualification unless they come back to the legislature again. Is that correct? We're going to have to change this. There's going to be some legislative action if lands must be qualified under those terms now. And if we're going to change this in the future, we'll have to come back and change the date again, will we not?
I believe that's correct. In terms of the 5 years that you use for measuring the $20,000 income from the effective date of this act, it would be 3 out of the 5 years preceding
the act.
This time.
So there's nothing perpetual about this. This is standard. We will have to move that standard if we decide to do it on a regular basis in the legislative process. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Thank you. Let me ask you another question. Pardon me, Mr. Chairman, but on the $20,000 figure, how are we going to arrive at that? How are we going to look there? Income tax statement, or how are you going to do determine the qualification? How are we going to do it?
I think the way that can be done, Senator, is at the present time when you qualify for tax deferral, there are similar income requirements and the same way that an assessor determines that there's language in the tax statutes about looking at either tax returns or other kinds of receipts that someone would normally use to prove that.
That's the way you're going to approach it then, huh?
I don't see why not.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
On page 2, line 21, we want to make it clear that within the marginal lands area, not only uses but divisions of land are allowable as well. So on line 21, after the word uses, we would say and divisions of land. And then over on page 3, between lines 9 and 10, we would add two new subparagraphs H and I that would make it clear that, one, divisions of land for single-family dwellings not smaller than 20 acres would be allowed, and divisions of land not larger than the minimum size necessary for those uses that are, or I should say, those non-residential uses that are allowed in the marginal land division. So we want to make it clear that you can have land divisions. You don't need to allow land divisions less than 20 acres because you already have the lot of record provision in this bill. So all those existing lots will be able to get their building permits. We think that will clarify the statute. There was some question about, on page 3, lines 16 to 19, what that meant and how that would work. What this section does is it allows counties to use this marginal lands provision whether they're now acknowledged or under a continuance or have not yet submitted their plans for review by the commission. The only restriction that this places is on specific land use decisions that they cannot be approved under the provisions of this act until the commission has reviewed and approved the designated marginal land areas and the plan and zone provisions applied to them. That is, county would go out, apply the provisions of this bill, designate some area for marginal land, set up its zoning ordinance with the proper uses. They could not immediately start issuing building permits or granting land divisions under this until it had been reviewed by the commission. Since it's such a new concept, I believe the idea of the bill is to make sure that it is reviewed and we make sure that it was done correctly. But it's not intended here to not allow or anyone to use this until they have already gotten acknowledgement the first time. On the lot of record section, which begins on page 3, line 20, and we would specifically refer you to lines 27 and 28, as it's presently written, this would say that lots of record were all lots created prior to the effective date of this act, which would run all the way back to the time Oregon joined the Union. and we think this is extremely broad, we would suggest two dates that would set a window on this window. It would be January 1, 1948 and January 1, 1978. So it would be lots within that period. We chose those dates for two reasons. One, the 48 date marks the point in time when counties were authorized to plan and zone in Oregon, and that was really the post-World War II building boom started at that time. And the 78 date comes immediately after the Oregon Supreme Court decision in Sunnyside versus Clackamas County, which was the case that said the goals clearly apply to specific land use decisions prior to acknowledgement. That case actually came down in September, so given the lag time for everyone knowing what the decision said, January 1, 78 would be a good window. So we would recommend those two dates. In section 4, which begins on page 5, and we would have amendments actually over on page 6, first we would point out that these uses that we're talking about are ones that apply in EFU zones, not in marginal lands. And our change deals with the allowance of a farm or forest-related dwelling on very small lots and dealing with what the standard would be. Down on line 23, have two amendments. One, say, is planted in perennials or trees to make it clear that trees are perennials. Secondly, it would say capable of producing an average of at least $10,000 in annual gross income upon harvest. Particularly when you're dealing with forest tree species, you sometimes don't harvest every year. You might have a varying rotation in your timber plan, and you might only harvest every 4 or 5 years. So that language will allow the person to average it out, as long as the average every year is $10,000, as opposed to having to come up with that every single year. So that's the purpose of that amendment, and
Mr. Chairman,
we'll add some flexibility.
How do you rationale? How do you? What's the rationale for $10,000? How do you come to that figure?
Yeah, I mean, well, I realize that it was put in by other. How do you feel that that's a rational figure?
Our look at the figure is, one, this particular section of the bill is looking at lots less than 20 acres. Those lots that are less than 20 acres and are smaller than the average of those grossing $2,500 in income. And the idea here is to ensure that someone on a very small lot is really out there farming and not just a hobby farm. Counties in our experience have had problems, or I should say, they can clearly tell when a small lot is a non-farm, and they can tell when it's over a certain larger size. It is clearly for resource purposes. But in doing case-by-case review, it's real hard in those in-between or smaller lots to tell whether or not it's for real. We don't have any empirical data on why $10,000 is better than any other figure. I could tell you in the unzoned tax deferral system, you need a minimum of about $100 an acre, and if you're up to 20 acres, you have to gross $2,000. And most people will agree that that's a very low figure. And if you lower the $10,000, you start losing that difference between the hobby farm and what might be a legitimate operation in perennials or birds.
There's no scientific research to support that figure, though, is there?
I haven't done any, and I don't know.
Thank you.
Two other amendments, Mr. Chairman. Subsection 5, which is on page 9, dealing with the notice requirements, line 22, we want to make it clear that, and would suggest that for applying the notice, that you would only have to give notice to people who are actually on farm deferral in an exclusive farm use zone. So if you run out only 800 feet, and you hit a rural residential zone, you wouldn't have to give notice to all the small lots and people who live there, since the intent of this notice provision is to ensure that farmers who might be impacted by increased rural residential development would have an opportunity to comment on it. So the language we're proposing would make it clear that They would notify people who are within an EFU zone and who are qualified for tax deferral under the EFU zone system. We would also suggest that that counties be given the authority to charge the cost of providing that notice to the applicant in this case. And finally, we would recommend recognizing that this is a new concept and recognizing that we're into some unknown territory, a monitoring clause similar to what was done for the lot of record provision in the last session that would say that the governing body or county shall keep a record of its actions under Section 2, which is the one that deals with designating marginal lands and setting up the uses that are allowed in marginal land areas, should keep a record of that and provide it to the commission when requested, and then that before each legislative session, we would report to the Joint Legislative Committee on Land Use the amount of land that had been designated or found to be marginal and the number of dwellings and land divisions that had been approved. And then we would be in a better position for evaluating this next time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there comments on these proposed changes?
No, I just appreciate, I know they had 2 days of commission hearings, and I appreciate you responding because we are under the gun. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I find most of these fairly constructive, and
we have anyone else, or are we in a work session?
Well, basically, Lois, did you want to make a brief comment on this since you're certain vested interest in the bill? Yes, sir.
I guess the only thing that I don't quite understand, maybe I've been slow in absorbing it, the second change that they're recommending on sub B of
Elder?
One, the land, instead of saying the land is not a part of the farm operation, the land does not make a significant contribution to. I guess I'm not sure that I can we define that? Is that I guess that's the only thing that's unclear about the whole presentation.
Is this what you're talking about right here?
Yeah. Okay. And maybe the other committee members are, and I guess I'd like one more quick shot at that explanation and then I'd be satisfied with what you say.
As it's worded now where it says the land is not a part of such a farm. I think the way that'll get interpreted is you have some land that is part of a farm that grosses over 20,000 acres, even if it's not being used in any relationship to that farmland, it would not be able to qualify. This allows people to say, well, sure, it's part of that operation, but it hasn't been used, it's not making any real significant contribution to that commercial farm. It's just been sitting there lying fallow. It hasn't been grazed because it doesn't really have good enough grass for grazing purposes. It's rocky. And the farmer's been probably looking for some way to either sell it off or doesn't really know what to do with it.
Is that going to provide for more splits?
I think it will allow some additional land to qualify as marginal land. It would still have to meet the test of either being low productivity or already being in small parcels. See, the way that the marginal lands definition works now, it can't be part of a farm that grosses over 20,000, and either it is at low productivity, either in terms of agricultural or forest site class, or it's already in parcels less than 20 acres.
So if I have, what about all the 380 acre farms around, and and that means that you could say, I've got 40 acres here that's not really a significant contributor, and so I'm going to cut it off and decide that it's marginal?
No, you'd still have to have at least 100 acres. In other words, when you're putting this through, it's not applicable to individual landholders separately. Mm-hmm. It works, as I understand it, you have to have at least 100 acres of land where 50% of the parcels are less than 20 acres. Or 100 acres in poor quality soil.
I guess, yeah, I'm still I just need to understand it better, and I would like to hear from Lois what her response is to that as well. Thank you.
For the record, I'm Lois Kanegi, Corvallis, Oregon, with Agriculture for Oregon. I'm grateful also with your committee for the work of the department on these proposed revisions. And I think Agriculture for Oregon does not have too much problem with any of them. I would like to comment on the question that Senator Cohen raised, because it is one that we do have problems with. And I must say that Agriculture for Oregon, working again between about December 1 and when did we come to with our bill, maybe early April, really grappled with that particular wording. We originally had put into that phrase on page 2, line 7, the land is not part of, is not a contributing part of a farm operation. And the reason we took that out was simply to make it a little more precise and to avoid the possibility of litigation, what is a contributing part, and so forth. However, you know, it's not a major problem with us, and if the department feels that that would be a more reasonable way to go, we're not going to object too strenuously. Our preference would have been to have left the contributing part out. Again, addressing Senator Cohen's concern about the 350-acre farms, our sense is that probably this would happen more directly in the large ranches, the cattle and wheat ranches, where the farms are more like 3,000 than 350. And Senator Hurd, probably from that part of the country, would be more aware of those sizes. But I believe it would be in that kind of large ranches where there might be some part of it which simply is not adequate for grazing. And if we're trying to be a little more reasonable and liberal in our land use provisions for the sake of people who have seen it as being unreasonable, then I suppose the contributing part will accomplish that. And I think we probably won't lose too much. Technically, I think that even if we didn't put contributing in there, if a rancher had a couple hundred acres of land that was Class 6 and that had not been using that, I believe that he could, in fact, sell that off, and then that could be developed as marginal land. So I don't think it's a big issue, and I'm not going to make a big point. I would like to comment on some other things, however. I have a suggestion for page 3, line 18, and I'm sorry, I didn't get an exact note of what the department was recommending. And the department...
Line 18?
Line 18, yes.
They're recommending the language.
Page 3 of the amendments, or the
page
bill?
3 of the bill. Of the bill.
Oh, the bill.
I mean
the
53183 bill. Yeah.
Well, they're proposing, if I can help her, Mr. Chairman, what they're proposing is really no change. The language just stays as is, the way I read their statement.
Well, I thought for clarity, and again, I'm not a legal mind and I don't know, but it may respond to Senator Day's concern if it would say, in substituting for the word approval there on line 18, subsection 1 of this section shall become effective only after acknowledgement, comma, periodic review, comma, or post-acknowledgement by the commission. Now, I don't know if that makes it clear or not, but that's one thing you might want to look at.
Well, we could add that and leave the RS in it. See, what 251 is the acknowledgement statute, and, of course, the post-acknowledgement is 605 through 650. So I must tell you, when I read that, it looked like we were going to start a whole new process over again, but they've convinced me that the error of my terrible ways to leave it alone. So,
well, if you're satisfied...
I'm enjoying hearing you say something, because I lectured them this morning over that, and they convinced me I was wrong. Okay.
Well, I think it says the right thing also, but I thought if you wanted to make it clear, that would be one way to go.
No, I think if even a lunk like me can figure it out, we'll leave it alone.
Okay, good. Page 6, here we come to the $10,000 figure that seems to be a problem for some persons. I want to just speak to that a little bit, if I may, to give you some additional clarification from farmers as to how $10,000 arrived, this figure. First of all, let me say again and again and again, we're talking about the provisions for farm dwelling in EFU zones. And this is on small parcels. It's not the conventional family farm. This is not in marginal land. It's not in rural residential land. It's EFU zone. You may recall some weeks ago, Mark Knapp, of a young farmer from Rickreol, showed up, and he talked about, on a hearing on this bill, and he talked about $20,000 as being peanuts, and $10,000 just nothing at all for a gross income for a farmer. For instance, I did a little calculating. At today's low filbert price of 37 cents a pound, and a very moderate yield of a ton per acre, on a 13.5-acre parcel of filberts, you would be able to gross $10,000. So we're talking about very small parcels. Bona fide farmers, even the very small bona fide farmers, will have no problems. There are lots of other options available for part-time farmers. Part-time farmers have marginal land, and again, the part-time farmers I know who are serious about part-time farmers, holding down two jobs, sometimes the wife does a lot of farming and the husband has another job, those people are making $10,000 gross, most of them. We're not talking about net, we're talking about gross. They don't make much profit, and they can always work those tax statements out so they can, you know, the poor farmer, we don't make any profit. I mean, you know, we're all guilty of it. But the gross is there. The gross is there. And let me remind you also that there will be small parcels available for these part-time farmers on marginal land.